Welcome into the Rise Up Reno Prevention Network show, brought to you every Saturday morning by StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. And of course, this show talks about helping our children do things or not do things that are bad for us. Right, Carla Smith?
That's right. I'm glad to be here again. We want to talk about stuff that's going to help our kids to have good choices and good options and be successful. And that's what we're here for today.
And, of course, Rise Up Reno Prevention Network was formerly called Communities That Care. We're still trying to get people used to that name.
We are. I'm still trying to get used to it. It was Communities That Care. We changed to Rise Up Reno Network Prevention. Prevention Network.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that long ago. And, of course, for people who want to contact the program, you've got lots of ways to do it. You're, of course, affiliated with USD 308, but you help all Reno County area schools.
Correct. Yes, if you want to find us, ask some questions, just give us a call, sign up for a program. Our number is 620-615-4018. And of course, you can find us on the web at riseupreno.org. And all of our contact information is there as well.
Well, this is in the past, so just a little update. Not that long ago, you had an empowerment-type summit.
We did. And it was awesome.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
It was really great. We had a great speaker, and we had breakout sessions. It was for 5th through 8th graders. So the high school youth leadership group put the conference on for the kids, and the kids come and break out into groups and get to hang out with their high school leader all day. They go to different breakout sessions. They talked about empowering themselves and looking out for each other. They talked about tobacco and how the tobacco industry targets kids. They talked about all kinds of great things. And then they also broke out into their group sessions and worked on just some ideas of goals and things they want to do with their future. We had pizza, we had donuts, we had a great time. It was really good.
And
we had a lot of fun.
Hopefully the turnout was good.
We did. We had a great turnout. It was a beautiful day, so it was really nice and went very, very well.
Well, of course, the show focuses on our young people, and you were able to nab another doctor from the Hutchinson Clinic.
I know. How lucky is that?
Let's introduce Dr. Michael Little. He's a pediatrician, basically new to the Hutch Clinic, and Dr. Little, welcome in. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So why don't you just tell us how long you've been in town and how long you've been with the clinic, a little bit of background, and I think you married a local gal.
I did. I was very fortunate to steal away a Yoder here.
Good, good. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I moved back to the area in October of in the last year, and my wife was born and raised here in Hutchinson, and I was born and raised out in Greensburg. Met her back in the middle 90s and swept her away to go to medical school, and she was fortunate to follow me along. So,
well, you know, I've got to ask, being from Greensburg, obviously the big tornado that went through, I assume you were in medical school and not in Greensburg.
I was actually in residency when that occurred. But yeah, it is still confusing and disorienting to go back there after growing up there all those years, and it seems like a different community, but they've done a fantastic job.
Certainly a life-changing event for those, well, really the folks all in Kansas, especially in Greensburg.
For sure.
Yeah. So, Carla, obviously you've got a pediatrician in here. He's going to probably talk a little bit about some of the health aspects and other ways that maybe we can impact our children as to not start using alcohol and tobacco, vaping products, all these other things.
Right, right, exactly. Since our program is brought to us by StopAlcoholAbuse.gov, I would like to talk about alcohol just a little bit with you. One of the things that I have noticed just from my research is that we find kids have a low perception of harm. And when they have that low perception, they think it's okay to start things because they don't really think it's going to hurt them. And I think we run into that with lots of substances. But alcohol, coming from, you know, being country kids or whatever, we kind of grew up around it. And our parents may have had it and their parents have it. So maybe they don't really figure it's going to hurt anything, that it's normal, that it's all right. So that's one of the reasons that kids start sometimes. What are some other factors maybe that you've noticed or that you're aware of that might give kids the inclination that it's okay to start?
Well, I think whether we're talking about any of those products, I think it's been legitimized by the adult population. I think there's certainly a component of peer pressure that plays a role in that. And I think being adults now, so to speak, my wife might argue with that, but being an adult now, we certainly think and look back, kids don't really have a realization of the dangers that those products have, whether we're talking about alcohol or illicit drugs or vaping or tobacco products.
Right. That's true. One of the things I read said that 4 out of 5 kids, and every time I hear 4 out of 5, that kind of cracks me up. But 4 out of 5 kids say that they would never use hard drugs like cocaine, meth, that kind of stuff, because they know that it's dangerous. But when you ask them if alcohol is dangerous, they, you know, very few of them believe that it is, because so many people use it and they see it so many places.
Well, and I think they have a perception that they maintain the control of their body, but they're not aware of how little alcohol it takes or how little illicit substance it takes to change their perceptions.
True.
And the risk that they're at just with other people having access to their drinks that can sometimes be unanticipated events that they're not.
That's really scary. That's nothing that I ever thought of when I was younger. We saw movies and we saw things where people would have big parties and, you know, somebody would end up passed out or somebody would do something, you know, terrible because they were, you know, under the influence and not making great decisions. But I never, ever thought about somebody putting something in my drink. And you hear about that a lot more now. Is that normal? I mean, does that happen a lot?
I think that it happens with increased frequency that we don't often, we're not often aware of.
True.
Especially in the older adolescent, young adult population, those kids going off to college, it's
right.
And they're not readily aware of or think of. They leave their drink unattended, they step away, someone steps in beside them and places something there. It puts them at great risk. And with the binge drinking that kids going off to college often participate with, it leaves them in a very vulnerable state.
Right. Binge drinking is for a woman, 4 or more drinks in a row. For a man, 5 or more drinks in a row. We tell kids if they are drinking all of those drinks in one setting, whether it's one party or one evening, that's binge drinking. That's drinking to get drunk. And if kids are drinking, a lot of times they're drinking to get drunk. So that binge drinking is a big deal. And binge drinking is going up in our county. I didn't write down the stats on that, but it is actually higher than it used to be. Just kids who drink on a regular basis is going down a little bit. So kids who drink at least once in the past, not necessarily in a specific time, would be 35.38%, and that's 6th through 12th graders. 12th graders who have drank in the past is 59.86%. And then when we're talking about binge drinking, you're talking about 16 to 17% of 12th graders have or do admit to binge drinking. So that can be a lot, and that's really dangerous. One of the things that I think kids don't realize is if they pass out, nobody's going to call the police. Nobody's going to take them to the hospital. They're putting themselves at danger just by drinking that much. But then also if somebody would spike their drink or something else would happen, or somebody, you know, somebody could hurt them when they're knocked out too. So it is very dangerous. That scares me for kids.
So, Dr. Little, why don't you talk about what you see in your practice? How long have you been in Hutchinson? Is it last October?
Just October of 19, I started here. I was in private practice in the Detroit area for 10 years prior to that.
So let's talk about fetal alcohol syndrome and maybe some generational problems with some of these. It's illegal for these children to be drinking, but, of course, it's you doctors do not recommend that pregnant mothers drink as well. What about do you see generational from some of these children that you see for whatever reason? Maybe they've got a cold or they've got a, you know, broken arm, whatever the case may be. You can't always directly ask about the alcohol use or abuse in the household, but I'm sure you probably on occasion have suspected it.
That is true. I think certainly we try to assess the risks in any child in a home and decide based on those assessments what substances the child or the infant might be exposed to, whether that's sadly an increasing form, neonatal abstinence syndromes, where they're exposed to other illicit drugs. Alcohol certainly continues to be a big component of that. With marijuana as accessible and the lines being certainly grayed in that area, that's an exposure risk for kids that we really don't have long-term studies to say what are the long-term effects on those kids.
So the legislature this year is going to look at medical marijuana. This is a little off topic here.
Go right ahead.
Or as the kids call it weed. That's what they call it here in town. I'm not sure that you have to declare where you stand on that, but I'm with you, and a lot of people are with you, that that drug in particular is illegal federally. If the states are going to nullify federal law and pass it anyway for medical use or recreational use, whatever they decide, Kansas is looking at medical use passage this year. I've always considered it a gateway drug, along with alcohol, along with some of these other perhaps a little more benign things that shouldn't kill you if you use them one time, for the most part, even though sometimes it can. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I think we should still stand firm as a society to keep those lines firm and clear for our adolescents on where we stand with marijuana and illicit substances. And by blurring those lines, it's hard then to come back and say, well, yeah, this is right, but this is not, and this is okay. And I stand with the gateway philosophy that as those drugs become endorsed by medical societies and by community and political leaders, it gives them an opportunity to think that, well, if this is okay, then certainly this drug is okay as well.
Right. And I think that's really brings us back to that perception of harm. If kids see that other people are using it, there's billboards with cartoon characters, it's available the next state over, their parents might be using it, then there's probably not any perception of harm. They don't think it's going to hurt them because other people are using it and not being hurt. And I think that's too bad. I think that we're going to see, as it becomes legal, more places, the accessibility gets higher, whether it's for medical or for recreational. There's just more available. There's more around, whether it's on mom's table or whether it's, someplace they could buy at the school. But it's going to be more available.
You're listening to the Rise Up Reno Prevention Network. We're visiting with Dr. Michael Little from the Hutchinson Clinic. He's a pediatrician, along with Carla Smith, who is the executive director of Rise Up Reno Prevention Network. And Dr. Little, so since you've been in Hutchinson, first of all, where did you practice before, or is this your first gig?
I've been in practice after residency in the Metro Detroit area, the Tri-County area of Detroit, and I practiced there for 10 years in a two-partner private practice.
So compare and contrast the communities. Obviously, most kids are the same anatomically, but the setting, the whole experience, what do you see as a difference?
Well, it's in some instances, it's a vast difference, and in some instances, it's very similar. The community I was in before is, a metropolitan area with an hour and a half of suburbs going between each end of the community, to now an hour and a half might get you halfway across the state.
Yeah.
So, right.
A big difference.
So were you in actually Detroit proper?
We were north of there about 15 miles is where my practice was located, and then lived about 20 miles north of Detroit proper.
So we've all heard of, the auto industry, as along with Motown, of course, in the Motor City.
For sure.
But they're like any major metropolitan area. They've got some blighted areas. They've got some very poor areas. And then, of course, the suburbs, a little more money. But any real differences, and I know I'm drilling down on you here a little bit, but as far as the type of children and the incidence of illness, were there different illnesses there? Were there different problems there than here? Or, like you said, is it about the same?
When you get to the inner city population, certainly the challenged individuals socioeconomically had much more risk factors as far as their health, their exposures to illness, their access to health care. Their resources with parental and caregiver support was lax. And those are probably things that are similar here. If there is a deficit in the socioeconomic status of an individual, that's a risk factor for them getting access to care and having a good quality home to be raised in to have support with educationally and medically.
So what about the parental aspect? Did you find the parental involvement in your practice in the Detroit area similar to here, or was it much different?
We were a little north of the downtown area, so we had a more affluent population, and so the parental involvement would be higher, and those kids tend to exceed and meet more educational standards. Certainly there was issues that would arise in exposures, and I think we'd still have the substance use and risks, but from an exposure from parental involvement, that would be less.
So, Carla, I think just a few weeks ago, the signs went up in all the convenience stores. You've got to be 21 in Kansas to buy tobacco products.
That's
Why don't
right.
you and the doctor
mm-hmm.
maybe discuss that a little bit?
Well, I was excited about that. I think that, and we did talk just a little bit earlier, I think that that's going to slow down the amount of it that's getting into the schools. I think if you've got to be 21 to purchase it, those 18-year-olds shouldn't be getting it as easily as they were before. So you can still get it online and say you're any age, but I don't think it'll be as easy to stop by the quick shop on the way to school. What do you
certainly
think?
Litigation that has been favored by pediatricians and I think a lot of clinicians and parents for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we look at studies, 90% of people that smoke started before the age of 18.
That's
and
right.
So just by pushing that age past 21, hopefully we can impact those rates. You know, it's truly, I look much like at vaping and nicotine use, as you mentioned for marijuana, the same way for nicotine. And it's an exposure risk that exposes those kids to early nicotine use.
Well, you want to give us some of the gory details on what happens to our lungs if we vape, which hasn't really been studied very much at all yet, other than Carl and I have talked many times in these shows about the kid that had the double lung transplant. So obviously that was not a good thing. Carla also brought up an article about some commercially available products that people didn't know they were buying these vapes with THC in it. And that was another problem. And then they were inserting vitamin E. It's a very similar consistency and looks a lot like that vaping product or the oil. But what happens to the body? And I assume it affects children a little more than it would a fully grown adult.
Well, I think everybody approaches these vaping products thinking they're safe. They think that they're a modality that can help them maybe quit smoking. They have a perception that they're less dangerous or safer than the actual tobacco products. And that simply, we don't have the research to know that yet. Many of the products that you have in combustible cigarettes are very much the same as what you would have, John, in products that are e-cigarette devices. We do know the vitamin E component has been a focus of high research because that seems to be one of the components that's associated with the vaping-associated pulmonary injury that has led to deaths across the country. I think when I was looking at statistics, there's two in Kansas as of November of last year. And
so two people have actually passed away?
In Kansas.
Okay.
And
right.
23, I believe, were hospitalized with confirmed cases of VAPI injuries or vaping injuries to the lungs.
So let's get a little deeper into why people use these products, and I'll bet there's a million different reasons, but these things are highly addictive, and I mean, of course, tobacco, alcohol, and then, of course, the illicit drugs that are frankly not legal to use. Is this being caused from depression? Is it you mentioned peer pressure earlier in the show, but the addictive qualities, I can't remember which drug it is. Maybe it's meth or one of the things that's rampant around here, literally, you use, maybe it's heroin. You use it once, and you got to have it again. So these things are life-altering, life-changing, life-ending sometimes.
They are. We talk about heroin being exactly that. One hit from heroin, and you're addicted. It has such a high addictive quality. When we talk about tobacco products and nicotine specifically, we think about 100 cigarettes is the statistics I've seen that is addicting.
And so five packs. Wow.
Right.
Or five pods, because a pod is as much nicotine as a pack.
That's exactly where I was going to go with it. So a pod's about one pack, and most of these kids that get involved in using these products are using one to two pods a day. When you drill down to older adolescents, they're not even able to estimate their usage because many of them are sharing the product throughout the course of the day. These pods are being broken apart. They're being manipulated to be able to hold THC products that then are even more dangerous. With some of the hash products, you can get almost 95% pure THC, which have significant psychoactive effects for these adolescents.
So how would a child present to you in a clinical setting where you would even think to ask them, hey, I don't know how you do it as a doctor. I mean, there's some lines you can't cross, I suppose, but have you had one yet that you say, come on, it looks like you're vaping to me, you're shaking, you're doing whatever, you're acting like you're using, I mean, how does that work?
Well, I think from a pediatric perspective, what we try to do as pediatricians is anticipate that they are using. And unfortunately, when you look at studies, about 30% of kids in high school are using vaping products, about 11 to 12% in the middle school population are using vaping products. And so you know, you're talking about a third of the kids coming through your door. You just have to simply ask the question. And from our perspective, I know parents get concerned about a confidential interview, but that's really the avenue for us to get in and drill down to those concerning risk factors that kids have, is just that opportunity to simply ask them.
So when I assume you've had some of these kids say, yeah, I do.
I do.
And then what do you do?
Well, I think that's the parity, is I think that when you, there was a study done by the AAP back in 2010, and they asked pediatricians if they asked, and they said, we do. But only half of them had answers for the kids when they said, yeah, I do use. And I think you have to have a plan in place, yes, that says, okay, I know you're using. You need to then assess their interest in quitting. And part of that component is providing them with the evidence and the literature to say, here are the risk factors if you continue doing this. You have to look at what the barriers are for them to quit using whatever substance, whether we're talking about alcohol, whether we're talking about tobacco products or other illicit substances. What are their barriers to stopping? We may assume that this is just because of peer pressure, but we have to look at their home life too, and there may be other confounding factors that are contributing to that. But once you have their interest in those risk factors, then we have to try to encourage them to get involved in some sort of treatment program. And the likelihood of a kid quitting a tobacco product on their own, stopping cold turkey, 12%.
That's not very good.
No, and so we've all heard people say, no matter their situation, I can stop anytime I want to stop, but that's about 12% likely to happen. Just by getting them involved in a counseling opportunity, we can double that and get it to about 24 to 25%.
So I presume you've never said, well, it's illegal that you're doing this, we're calling the cops. That's probably not the approach you take.
That's never the approach we take. And certainly that's not the benefit of the child to put them in that situation. Our goal is to get them the help they need. And part of that confidential interview is trying to introduce that back to their parents, too, in a safe environment where they can not get yelled at, but, you know, get them into a treatment modality.
Yeah, wake them up and say, look, yeah, this is going to change your life if you don't quit, and not for the better. Again, you're listening to the Rise Up Reno Prevention Network show. Of course, this Carla Smith is the executive director of that. We're visiting with Dr. Michael Little. And Carla, we've only got 3 minutes left, but time really flies.
I know, it always goes too fast. I always think we should do this longer, but we're nervous coming in and then it just is gone. So, yeah. Dr. Little, everything you're saying is just right on task with what we also want for kids. We want them to have an opportunity to talk to somebody safely, an opportunity to get some support, and then to talk to those parents to help them get more support. 12% quitting on their own, that's not very many of them. And we have a lot of kids that are using them. So whether it's, like you said, alcohol or vapes or marijuana, people need support to quit things, and kids need support all the way.
Carla, I've got another question for the doctor real quick.
All right, let's do it.
So, Dr. Little, you're on the front line, you know, helping these kids directly. The parents, of course, are the front line, so hopefully they're staying involved. But in Carla's group, they have a lot of seniors and juniors in high school that will go talk to the underclassmen. And she's told me many times that the impact that a senior student has on an underclassman is completely different than a doctor, a parent, an adult, a police officer talking to him. So the more these seniors, juniors, sophomores that can help these younger kids, the better.
That's true. And I think it's very important, and peer pressure in a different way, to try to encourage them not to be involved in the use of those. One study I saw is if you're a child using, or an adolescent rather, using these substances, and you have a best friend that continues to use, your chance of quitting is less than 20%. If you have a best friend that does not smoke, your chance of quitting by 28 is almost 75%. So, you know, if these upperclassmen can befriend and lead these individuals in a positive manner, the likelihood is that they will not smoke, or if they are, be able to transition out of using these types of products.
So, Carla, obviously for parents and grandparents listening, get those kids involved and let them help each other.
That's right. Let those kids help each other. Also, make sure that you're getting them the support they need. So they may need more than just parents telling them what to do. So help them find a quit line. Help them find resources for how to quit, because it's not easy. It's a hard thing to do.
Give people the contact information for Rise Up Reno Prevention Network.
RiseUpReno.org. We have lots of resources on our website. And, of course, you can call us anytime. 620-615-4018.
Carla, thanks for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Dr. Little, a pleasure meeting you. Welcome to the community, and thanks for your
time.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yep, you bet. All right, we'll have the Rise Up Reno Prevention Network right back here at the same time next week.